So after addressing the situation in the Middle East, it was back to the Ukraine crisis for President Obama. 4-day European trip all about reassurance for NATO members who border Russia and have sizable Russian-speaking populations. Estonia's one. So are the other two Baltic states, Latvia and Lithuania. They do not want to end up like non-NATO member Ukraine with a breakaway territory and Russia seeming to foment separatist fever. Though Russian President Vladimir Putin has made no claim for the Baltic states, many Estonians remain concerned. Raimo Palm is head of international news for the Estonian daily Eesti Päevaleht. He spoke to us from the capital Tallinn about what kind of reassurances Estonia hopes for from President Obama's visit.
If you look at what the maximum expectations are, then, of course, Estonia would like to see permanent bases, just as Latvia, Lithuania and Poland would like to see, and far more visibility of NATO allies over here on the ground. But being realistic, it's probably going to be a little bit smaller than Estonians actually hope for.
Given that Vladimir Putin allegedly said that he and his forces could take Kiev in 2 weeks, do the people of Estonia worry that without those bases, he could make the same claim about Tallinn?
Estonians are not worried that Mr. Putin might actually stake his claim on Estonia and Latvia. But what Estonians are worried about is that NATO's presence is over the light side at the moment.
What evidence do you have that the Russians are thinking about the Baltics? And of course, we should note there is a sizable Russian population in every one of the Baltic countries, so Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia particularly.
I would like to make it really clear that there's no evidence that the Russians are thinking about the Baltics at the moment. There's only indirect suggestions. But you have to take into account that the Soviet Union incorporated three Baltic states involuntarily into its system in 1940. So what Mr. Putin is doing now with Ukraine, if you look at it from the point of view of him actually increasing his empire with regular armed forces, then you could make a sort of a parallel that he might want to do that in other bits, Belarus or Kazakhstan, or then the Baltic states.
Do the Russians in Estonia read your paper, Eesti Päevaleht?
Oh, they do. They do. It's an interesting thing that is going on in terms of that we are always speaking about Russian-speaking people in Estonia, but there are Russian-speaking people coming from Russia. There are Russian-speaking people coming from Ukraine. So if you look at the moment, there are really divergent views on what's going on.
Would you say that Estonia is a divided country as far as figuring out how to respond and where to go from here?
No, I think there's no division at all. I think the broad view is that you just have to show your strength, and the strength lies in relations with the United States, NATO, the European Union, and so on. It's placing Estonia to the West, and I think that the broad view is overall shared by everybody.
So Estonia is not divided, but does Estonia look West and see a divided NATO, particularly as regards Washington and, say, Berlin?
I think there is an internal split on how to react, whether to increase sanctions or not. So I think, yes, that's most sort of persistent Estonian worry, is that the places that the country wants to belong to and make a commitment to are at times at odds with each other.
Before we go, in all of this crisis, it's conceivable that Russia could make it pretty darn cold in Tallinn come winter with the energy dependency that the Baltics have. What's your view on that?
Oh, they can't make it that cold. Yes, if you look at the numbers, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are probably dependent on Russian gas. But if you look at the share of the gas in the energy mix, it's tiny for Estonia. So they can't make it cold, and they won't make it cold. Bear in mind, Mr. Putin is entirely dependent on the funds that he gets from selling his gas and his oil, mostly to Europe. And there's no question of him cutting the flows. There's absolutely no question. If he did that, he would be brought down, I think, within a week.
Raimo Palm, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The confident Raimo Palm spoke with us from Tallinn in Estonia. He's head of international news for the Estonian daily newspaper, Eesti Päevaleht. Uncertainty over a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Poroshenko holds direct phone talks with Vladimir Putin, he says, and says an agreement on a ceasefire is in place. Then he later called it simply a process on the way to a ceasefire. Russia, meanwhile, said it is all for a ceasefire, but denied it is part of the conflict, and so it has no fire to cease. Pro-Russian separatists claim they will agree to nothing until Ukrainian forces withdraw from eastern Ukraine. At the same time, NATO is busy reassuring Russia's nervous neighbors that it is serious about clarifying Vladimir Putin's loose idea of eastern European borders. The president's visit to Estonia is part of this no-nonsense approach to NATO members regarding any idea of Russian expansion. In Wales, a critical NATO meeting this week will discuss the issue of forward bases and the deployment of as many as 4,000 troops in eastern Europe. Russia is raising the stakes by redefining NATO as a military threat to Russia and will deploy its forces accordingly. David Gress is the author of From Plato to NATO, The Idea of the West and Its Opponents. He joins me now. David Gress, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what can NATO do in terms of forward bases, and how many forward bases are there already in Eastern Europe, do you think?
Well, there aren't that many, and 4,000 is not a high number. And NATO, as you said, was to reassure the Eastern Europeans who were formerly under the Soviet Union and don't want to come back under Russian rule that they would be defended. And that's, you know, fine. But the problem, of course, is that Putin can easily overrule them by escalating his rhetorical strategy of saying, as you said, that NATO has become a threat, which is also, of course, not true. So I think we have a rhetorical escalation here, which could be dangerous, but at the moment is not more than that.
Let's talk a little bit about this military threat idea. Does that constitute a reversal from the Bill Clinton years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does, because under Clinton, I mean, we were just after the Cold War, and Russia was in turmoil. Boris Yeltsin was in charge, he wasn't really in charge. There was all sorts of internal trouble that they had, and therefore there was just no way that either Russia could threaten NATO or NATO could really threaten Russia. The job at that point was to secure stability in Eastern Europe as far as possible through economic reform, economic growth. And NATO, as you may recall, was involved in the Balkans at that time. And so there really was no reason for any tension between Russia and the West in the 90s. This really begins to go off the rails just in the last 3 or 4 years with what's been happening in Ukraine mainly.
We're talking to David Gress, who's the author of From Plato to NATO, The Idea of the West and Its Opponents. So during the Warsaw Pact years of the Cold War, the configuration of NATO was, far fewer troops than Russia had at that Warsaw Pact border. The idea was that Russia could overwhelm Europe, and so the deterrence was missiles, intermediate missiles, long-range missiles. It was the nuclear deterrence that constrained Russian troops. We don't have that option now, so it seems like NATO doesn't even have a plan A here.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there still is a U.S. arsenal. And as far as I'm aware, the Russian arsenal has degraded considerably because of some lack of funds to maintain it and general confusion and corruption and perhaps a bit of black market selling off of nukes. So I suspect that at the top level, the deterrent still works. But we're talking about a much, much lower level. We're talking about geopolitics in the Ukraine. We're talking about Eastern Europe. And there, yeah, I mean, as I said at the outset, I mean, it doesn't really have the manpower to mount a credible deterrent to the Russian forces if they want to play hardball. But you see, I don't think they do. I think this is a rhetorical strategy, and what the Russians hope to get out of it, what Putin hopes to get out of it, is probably some kind of deal over the Ukraine where he gets to have more influence in the eastern Ukraine and perhaps also more influence in the Baltic states. That would seem to be the Russian strategy. I mean, they want to try to reconstitute something like the Soviet Union without calling it that, without actually annexing anybody. But that seems to be where they're going.
Now, NATO was established to keep Russia from expanding in the way that it did during the Soviet Union or the way that it was envisioned during World War II. If NATO becomes a negotiating partner for Russia to acquire territory, it seems to me the whole reason for NATO kind of crumbles to dust.
Yeah, well, that's never going to happen overtly. And I think that the sort of bargain that could be struck here is for NATO to say, okay, you know, we would like to, you know, we guarantee the security of certain East European countries that want to become members. Clearly, Poland is the main case here. But we're not going to interfere with Russian interests. Now, of course, then, what are Russian interests? And as I said before, I think the Russian interest is to acquire some kind of loosely formulated veto power over the politics of countries like Ukraine and maybe Estonia, short of actual annexation, which the Russians well know would be an absolute red trigger for NATO, and then you see defense budgets going up really fast. So I don't think they're going to try that. But they are going to try to push at what they perceive to be soft bots in sort of the NATO armory, both the military armory and the rhetorical armory, to see how far they can go in this strategy of slowly reabsorbing or gaining influence in some of the Eastern European countries.
Well, let's see how far they can go, at least in your view here. We say goodbye to Georgia. We say goodbye to Crimea. It sounds like you're saying we can easily say goodbye to Eastern Ukraine. We might even say goodbye to Estonia here. That doesn't sound like a, you know, fortress against Russian expansion.
No, you're right. It doesn't. But the thing is, I'm not so worried as it would have been 30 years ago. I mean, the Soviet Union was seriously an enemy of the West, enemy of democracy, enemy of freedom, all these things. I don't see Putin's Russia at all in the same light. I think it's a nationalistic regime and can be deterred and persuaded by old-fashioned geopolitics. Again, I don't think that they're going to go for actual control of Ukraine or Estonia, but they are going to go for more influence. And in Ukraine, don't forget, Ukraine is very divided. The western part of Ukraine will never become pro-Russian. It's always been pro-West European. Eastern Ukraine is basically pro-Russian. And Estonia is a small country. There are a lot of Russians who live there. They were put there by the Soviets to dilute the Estonian nationality, and that's worked pretty well. So there are a lot of Russians there. And they could credibly argue that they need to be protected against the Estonian majority, whatever. But apart from those two cases, I mean, Poland is never going to go pro-Russian. Belarus, yeah, they're pro-Russian, so maybe they'll fall at some point. But that, it kind of stops there. I'm not seeing a scenario of Russian tanks rolling across the North German plain as we used to fear in the 80s. That's not on the agenda at all.
David Gress is the author of From Plato to NATO, The Idea of the West and Its Opponents. He spoke with us from Denmark. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.